Hi there, thanks for downloading Between the Lines. And just before the program starts, I'd like to tell you about my colleague Richard Adie and his program Best Practice. It's about getting stuff done at work, like the best way to hold a meeting and the best way to speak to management and survive. Tune in at 12:30 on Sunday or 11:30 every Tuesday, or look for Best Practice on the RN homepage, ABC Radio app, or wherever you listen to podcasts. It's really good stuff. G'day and welcome to Between the Lines. I'm Tom Switzer. Last week, the two most unpopular, untrustworthy, polarising US presidential candidates in living memory debated each other. And the kindest thing that has been said about them is that they lived up to those expectations. Now this week, the dullest and most vanilla vice presidential candidates debated each other, and it's been said they did not live up to those expectations. In fact, far from boring, it was a lively exchange. Now, how does all this affect the race to the White House? Is Hillary now the firm favourite after another erratic week for the Donald? Our panel on American politics coming up soon. Plus, Malaysia is back in the news. And no, I'm not just referring to the controversy surrounding those young Australians who stripped down to Malaysian flag printed swimwear. I mean Malaysia's corruption scandal. Now, that could threaten not just a presidency, but the 60-year-old nation. Stay with us for that. We all know about Donald Trump's many mistakes, setbacks, offensive remarks, and so on throughout the past 12 months, and yet he's still competitive in the race to the White House. Now, sure, Hillary Clinton scored a bounce after the first presidential debate, but the reality remains a majority of Americans clearly don't want to vote for the former senator and secretary of state. She's widely derided as the most unpopular, untrustworthy, and polarizing presidential candidate in living memory. Bar one, Donald Trump. So what's likely to happen in the final month of this exceedingly long campaign? Carlin Bowman is a senior fellow and research coordinator at the American Enterprise Institute in Washington, D.C. She's one of America's leading authorities on polls and public opinion. Nicole Hemmer is assistant professor at the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia. She's also author of Messengers of the Right, published this month and reviewed most favorably in the Wall Street Journal recently. Carlin, Nicole, welcome to ABC Radio.
Thank you for having us.
Now, let's get your reaction to the vice presidential debate this week. Mike Pence, Tim Kaine, who won and does it really matter? Carlin.
Mike Pence was a clear winner in this debate, mostly on points on style, but the debate wasn't really a lot about substance, and I think it doesn't matter. Vice presidential debates are only of minor importance in American politics because Americans are voting for the top of the ticket.
Yeah, well, some pundits say that Pence was so much better than Trump last week that he showed up his leader. Nicole, what's your response to that?
Well, I think that that's entirely possible. Not only did he show up Trump, but he kind of pretended Trump didn't exist, at least not in the form that we've seen Trump over the course of the last 15 months. Tim Kaine, however, was more than happy to put Trump front and center in the debate. And I think that that was a pretty good sign of what the Clinton camp's theory of the campaign is. If you keep all eyes on Trump, they believe they're going to win. And that's what Kaine was trying to do last night.
Yeah, and Pence, in a way, contradicted Trump on things like Russia and deporting illegal immigrants. Now, Trump's an unconventional Republican. I think a lot of Australians still are coming to grips with the ideological or the political dynamics of Trump because he espouses few of the party's traditional positions, you know, on free trade, foreign policy, immigration. It's been noted that almost every important conservative publication opposes Trump, as do most leading conservative columnists. Yet Trump's receiving about the same level of support from Republicans as previous Republican presidential candidates. Carlin, what's going on here?
There's no question the Republicans have coalesced around Trump. He's enjoying about 90% approval among them, just as Hillary Clinton is enjoying about 90% approval among Democrats at this particular point. This is a different country, I think, after the 2008 financial crash and what's followed that and the extraordinary stagnation of wages that many Americans have been feeling for now quite a while, I think has produced an electorate that really, and these are Donald Trump supporters, want fundamental change.
Yeah, well, the last time so many Republican leaders defected, and you think of the Bush family right now, they've defected from Trump. That was in 1964. Now, Nicole, you've studied 1964 pretty closely. Barry Goldwater was the candidate. He was wiped out in a landslide. That won't happen this time. Why?
No, I think there's much more party unity this time around. And I think there's a much more polarized and partisan political environment than we saw in 1964. In 1964, you had liberal Republicans, you had conservative Democrats. There was a lot more room to move between the two parties. That's not really something that we see as much today.
Well, to what extent is the Republican Party divided between mainstream conservatives and the more populist rank and file that's attracted to Trump, Carlin?
Well, clearly he's enjoying strong support among Republicans nationally, but there are deep divisions in the elite culture of the Republican Party. And as you suggested, many of the major conservative columnists, many of the major conservative publications have not endorsed Trump. So there is clearly a division right now in the ranks.
Well, one person who thinks that Trump has a good chance of winning is the left-wing movie maker Michael Moore. Let's get your reaction to something Moore told NBC's Meet the Press last weekend.
I've been trying to say for months here, I live in Michigan, and across the Midwest, across the Rust Belt, I understand why a lot of people are angry, and they see Donald Trump as their human Molotov cocktail that they get to go into the voting booth on November 8th and throw him into a political system that has made their lives miserable.
Michael Moore on why Trump resonates with so many Americans who are railing against Washington. Carlin Bowman.
I'm not sure that most Americans are miserable, but they certainly feel they're falling behind and they're worried about their futures and their children's futures. This is particularly true in the industrial Midwest, where a lot of jobs have been lost. And I think that's what Michael Moore is talking about. And it's real, and Trump has been tapping into it.
Yeah, but Trump, Nicole, I mean, as you know, after the debate, he kept turning to social media, unleashing a storm of tweets against what a former Miss Universe winner. Two things here is Michael Moore's analysis plausible given that Trump keeps pursuing defensive, egotistical sideshows?
Well, I mean, the core of Trump's appeal to many voters is this idea that he says what's on his mind and that he appeals to this white working class vote. I mean, we should keep in mind that Michael Moore said in 2012 that Romney was going to win the election.
Is that a fact?
So it is. And the reason he did, and I think is important for understanding why he's saying that Trump might, is that it's a reflection of what Michael Moore thinks about politics. He thought Romney would win because he believed money had so much influence over politics that Romney could buy his way to victory. Michael Moore has long talked about the white working class and its embattled position in the United States. And I think his position on the 2016 race is a reflection of that as well.
Yeah, but let's remember those Rust Belt states, particularly Pennsylvania, that has gone Democrat in every presidential election since 1988. Hillary has a lead there, but it has narrowed from a month, 2 months ago. To what extent would that worry Democrats that Trump is making inroads with the white working class in the Rust Belt?
Oh, I think they absolutely are worried about it.
It should worry Democrats very much. But of course, Hillary Clinton is much stronger than expected among white Republican women. Mm. And that may counteract some of his strength among the white working class. But clearly in states like Ohio, she's gained a little ground recently. Pennsylvania, those are very, very key states in this election campaign.
Nicole, sorry, I cut you off.
No, that's fine. Democrats today are talking about what the map might look like if they begin to lose those Rust Belt states. And they note that definitely Clinton will want to win places like Pennsylvania and Michigan, but she could give up Ohio and replace it with places like Colorado and Nevada and maybe pick up some of those states that have been trending purple in the last few cycles.
My guests are Carlin Bowman from the American Enterprise Institute in Washington, where I worked in the 1990s, and Nicole Hemmer. She's a colleague of mine these days at the U.S. Studies Center, and you can read her weekly columns on American politics in the Age newspaper in Melbourne. Now, Hillary, she got a bump in the poll in the past week or so. Carlin, does this mean she's now the firm favourite for the November 8 election?
I don't think so. I think this is still a very close election. She's clearly gained ground. And if you look at the electoral map, which Nicole was talking about, she does have some very key advantages electorally in terms of that map overall. But I think this is still a very close race and anything can happen. One of the things that we've seen in this campaign is how much the narrative has changed week by week. We're always focusing on something new, and that's probably a reflection of social media. So I wouldn't want to predict, but I'd say at this point, this week, it's it's still a very close race.
Right. Well, I mean, Nicole, on that note, I mean, some say Hillary's biggest problem remains the fact that she represents the status quo. You know, the question is that what's she going to do differently? How's she going to be a change agent in Washington? And if you look at some of those battleground states, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Florida, you've got something like 70% of voters in those states, according to Quinnipiac, they want radical change. How would you respond to that argument?
Well, I think that what we saw last night at the vice presidential debate is that that's not going to be the tack that Clinton takes in order to finish out the next 5 weeks of this election. She probably can't position herself as a change agent. And if she had an opportunity to do that, she could have done it through somebody like Kane. If he would have come there as the likable Kane, as the authentic Kane, that might have been an indication that the Clinton camp was going to try to take a different tact by putting Trump front and center in the vice presidential debate in the way that Clinton's been approaching the campaign in the last month or so. I think that's what we're going to see. And she's not going to make the positive case for change, but instead is going to make the negative case that she's not Donald Trump.
Yeah, that's right. No, she's making the referendum on Donald Trump's temperament. Now, if she wins, America, of course, will have its first female president. What might she expect? Here's Australia's first female prime minister, Julia Gillard, on CNN last weekend on whether a President Hillary is likely to expect misogyny.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I think a different standard in all senses. The nature of the insults against her in what has been a very ferocious campaign, lacking any form of politeness or civility. The insults against her are very often gendered insults. The scrutiny on age questions, I think, has played out differently for her. I think people do see women age and come to a different set of conclusions than men age. I think that there has been this question for her of likability. One of the key issues her campaign wanted to deal with was the widely held perception that Hillary Clinton isn't likable. I know Hillary Clinton, she's incredibly likable, and I actually think people have come to that conclusion partly through the prism of gender, partly because of this unconscious bias that a woman who's right up there must be, you know, a pretty tough sort. So I think that there's lots of levels, a different set of tests being run over Hillary Clinton than over Mr. Trump, or at an earlier stage of the contest, the other potential candidates.
Julia Gillard on CNN recently on sexism in politics. Now, is that how Hillary will be treated in the White House, Carlin?
I don't think so. I certainly agree with the Prime Minister that this has not been a civil campaign, that it's been a very, very tough campaign overall. But Hillary Clinton herself has said that she isn't likable in many ways, that she has a very hard time connecting with voters. I know that people who know her personally find her very, very easy to relate to, but she just doesn't connect. And I would say that about a man or a woman in that position overall. I don't expect she's going to be treated particularly differently if she becomes the president. Yes, there'll be the kinds of snide comments that we've heard, but you know, that's part of this game, and I just think it is.
Nicole, you live during part of the Julia Gillard prime ministership in Australia. What do you make of the former prime minister's remarks that Hillary Clinton will be treated differently in the White House because she's a woman?
Well, I think it reflects Gillard's experiences as prime minister and having to face sexism in her own political career. And I do think it's something that Clinton will have to face. I think Clinton actually benefits from running against Donald Trump because he has sort of an old school sexism that runs not just with Clinton, but in a lot of the different women that he talks about over the course of his campaign. And I actually think that helps her in a way because Clinton has not really resonated with young women. She represents a much different type of feminism than millennials today embrace. And having someone like Donald Trump who embodies that sort of old school sexism, I think actually helps unite more women behind her than she would necessarily get if she were facing a more traditional candidate.
It's interesting because, correct me if I'm wrong, Hillary Clinton did not really generate enthusiasm among the millennial female voters in the Democratic primaries when she was up against a 74-year-old man, right?
That's absolutely right. The millennial vote has not coalesced around Clinton, and that's why I think some of these other wedge issues can help at least draw some subcategories of millennials into her camp, because she's not a change agent. She's not somebody that they see as a radically different type of candidate who will shake up politics, and correctly, in my view.
Yeah. Nicole, Carlin, it's been a pleasure. To be continued. Thanks so much for being on the show.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Tom.
That was Carlin Bowman from AEI in Washington, and via Skype, Nicole Hemmer, author of Messengers of the Right, and also a colleague of mine at the US Studies Centre.
On RN, this is Between the Lines with Tom Switzer.
Last year, the Wall Street Journal discovered evidence of potential corruption involving Prime Minister Najib Razak. Something like $700 million linked to the state-owned investment fund was allegedly transferred into his personal accounts. Now, Najib denies all wrongdoing. His spokesmen have dismissed critics as part of a conspiracy to overthrow an elected leader. Certain enemies, we're told, are politicising it. He's even warned that foreign enemies could impose neo-colonialism if Malaysians share confidential documents with outsiders. Here's a classic Najib quote. History is a testimony of how we could lose our sovereignty if we were in cahoots with foreigners. Well, let's talk more about all this with someone who specialises in Southeast Asia. Kirsten Steiner is a senior lecturer at the Monash Business School in Melbourne. Kirsten, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for the invitation, Tom.
Now, can Najib Razak survive this corruption scandal?
Tom, this is the $10 million question at the moment, because we are seeing different phases in this scandal. We had an initial phase that was what I would call the national phase, where domestic investigations started around the scandal, and we had numerous investigations. We had the central bank, which investigated the alleged misappropriation of the money, and initially they suggested that prosecution should be commencing, but they changed their tune, and in May this year, the investigation was closed, and one MDB, this is the investment fund, was just fined. We also had the Attorney General investigating last year, and he was removed and replaced by a federal court judge, and the investigation were closed as well. Now, there have been rumors that this previous Attorney General pretty much had arrest warrant prepared for Najib, and this was one of the reasons why he was replaced.
Well, let's be clear here, just for listeners who aren't on top of this issue. Najib, he says nearly $700 million that ended up in his personal accounts was a legal political donation from Saudi Arabia that was later mostly returned, right? But can he get off so easily if it's proved that national wealth held by this fund disappeared on his watch?
Well, the national investigations so far have been clearing him. That is the interesting part. So as I said, the Attorney General investigation went nowhere. The Auditor General reports, which came out earlier this year, was deemed classified, and opposition party member who leaked some details were charged. So far, he has been keeping a close lid on what's going on nationally in the investigation. The interesting part is the international side, which is really coming to the forefront this year.
And this is led by the United States, I take it?
Well, it's led by the United States, but it's also closer to home. Singapore, the prosecutor in the High Court, called this one of the biggest financial scandals he's seen. Luxembourg and Switzerland are investigating as well. But of course, the US is the one that is taking the limelight a bit, because it does involve the financing of a Hollywood movie. And that does make a pretty good story, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, some commentators, and we heard some of this on the ABC's Four Corners earlier this year, they argue that Najib could actually turn this case to his advantage and play what's called the Malay nationalism card. What does that mean, Kirsten?
Now, what you have to understand with Malaysia is we're talking about a multiracial, multi-ethnic society. And we have got about 23.8 million people, about 61.3 are Malays, ethnic Malays. Ethnic Malays are also people who are deemed Muslims automatically according to the constitution. The rest are about 20% Buddhist, we've got 9% Christian and 6% Hindus. And if you're looking at Malaysian politics, this is deeply divided along ethnic lines. The majority of the parties are representing a certain ethnic constituency. And UMNO, this is the Prime Minister's party, has always represented the interests of the Malay majority population. It has been in competition there with PAS, and they have been trying to out-Islamicize each other. They are making Islam one of the big topics in order to convince their voters that they are representing their interests. Now, the interesting part is that we see a diversion. Malaysian politics dividing. So the two major parties, UMNO, for instance, following the scandal, has split. There are people who have been expelled from UMNO. That is the former deputy prime minister who is now heading the new party. Mm-hmm. Mahathir, the former prime minister, left the party and is in the new party.
No stranger to Australia, of course. Now, he's in his early 90s now, and he's just set up this new opposition party, right?
Yes, he has.
Well, does that pose a serious challenge to Najib?
I think they could have the potential to divide the Malay voters, absolutely, if they are getting their act together. And this is still early days we're talking, but he has been able to manage to get a few high-profile former UMNO politicians. As I said, the former deputy prime minister is president of the party. Mahathir is the chairman. His son, who was state prime minister as an UMNO representative of a state, Kedah, is now vice president of the new party. So we see that this scandal has split the party.
Yeah, but I mean, I would have thought that many in the UMNO government are more likely to remain loyal to the prime minister. After all, if Razak goes, the whole system could go. I mean, this is a party that's been controlling Malaysian politics, what, for 60-odd years?
Yes, ever since independence. Yeah. So I agree. What we see is everyone who was disloyal to Najib is gone in UMNO. So they have been sidelined, they have been expelled, and the way for them to organize themselves is in this new party. UMNO itself is still holding steady to Najib. Mm-hmm. We've seen that the party elections have been postponed to after the next general elections, which are scheduled for 2018, but might come earlier than we anticipated.
If you've just joined us, you're on RN. You're with me, Tom Switzer, and my guest is Kirsten Steiner from the Monash Business School in Melbourne. The subject, Malaysia's corruption scandal. Kirsten, could Najib hold on to power by stoking resentments against ethnic minorities?
Well, this is a typical card that is quite often played in Malaysian politics, that when elections are coming around, certain sentiments are coming to the forefront. We've seen it when the Islamic card, and this is the Malay sentiment, is being played. Last elections, there were matters of how religious tax or zakat is being played. There have been matters on how the legal system is perceiving family disputes, particular interfaith, interreligious disputes, etc. So all these things are always heating up in the wake of a general election. So yes, this could be happening at the moment. His approach seems to be more on a general base. So for instance, we've seen the passing of the new NSCA, the new National Security Council Act, which is giving him quite broad powers in order to declare a state of emergency. In fact, that move has been seriously criticized by the Council of the Rulers, which refused to give their royal assent to this new law.
Yeah, well, many Western human rights groups, not surprisingly, would say that, you know, because of the racial divide, it means playing the Malaysian nationalism card. That would be a powerful and dangerous weapon. What would be the cost to Malaysia if Najib goes down that road?
I do not think that the racial card with regards to the scandal is going to be that affected. They've tried to play the racial card last year after the last general election, which was a very close call. And the ruling coalition party and UMNO in particular said they had been deserted or betrayed by the other ethnicities. Right now, what we see is a much broader approach to silencing dissidents. It's not only focusing on one particular race. You can see this also, the critics and the people requesting for Najib to step down are across all ethnicities. So I doubt that the ethnicity card is going to be the most effective one. It's going to be the general security card. It's going to be, we've got to keep Malaysia strong from external threat. And considering a foreign conspiracy is a quite common theme in Malaysian politics.
Some people would say that Najib's position as a moderate Muslim ally would shield him or Malaysia from US legal actions. He does, after all, have a close relationship with President Obama. Is that a plausible argument, Kirsten?
Well, it depends. We're still early in the US case. What we only have is the documents, and they are talking about Malaysian official one. And that's been described as a high-ranking official in Malaysian government who also held a position of authority in 1MDB. And if you're looking at the lawsuit that was filed by the Department of Justice in late July, they have been at pains to not name him, but to give enough descriptors to be clear of who it is. So I think it's going to wait and see how this is going to be pinning out, to be honest.
Okay, final question. Will things fall apart in this Malaysian Federation?
Ooh, that's a tough one. Well,
there is a danger of this spiralling out of control.
There is. But so far, as I said, Najib has been keeping it very close under control in his party and also domestically with silencing the investigation.
Mm-hmm.
What I like to compare it to is an iceberg. Like with an iceberg, we still have 80 or 90% underwater. So you pretty much don't know whether the iceberg is going to sink the ship until you really run into it and see the mass underneath the waterline. It is a difficult one. I think it remains to be seen how these new parties, which role they're going to be playing in Malaysian politics. Remember, we not only have the split in UMNO, but we also have the split in PAS last year. So we've got now where we had two parties competing for the Malay votes, we now have four parties. And what this will do to the base is still unseen because they are brand new. Also, it is a question what UMNO's coalition partners will do. The coalition holds 139 seats in parliament, but only 88 are in fact belonging to UMNO. That means out of the remaining 44, if we only had 23 defecting, we could have a vote of no confidence.
Well, these are intriguing developments in Malaysian politics. Kirsten, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thank you so much for the invite.
That was Kirsten Steiner from the Monash Business School in Melbourne. And don't forget our recommended list online. Now, one article worth consulting is Jeffrey Wycroft's review of the Chilcot Report. Now, that's in the latest issue of the New York Review of Books. Now, you may recall Wycroft. He was a guest on Between the Lines earlier this year to talk about the future of the monarchy on the Queen's 90th birthday.
George Orwell, who was a radical in every way, said that he wanted to keep the monarchy because it meant that you could have a symbol as head of state, rather than a head of state exercising real power and doing so with malign consequences. He was living in the age of Hitler and Stalin. You know, the fact of having a head of state who is completely above politics is really a brilliant constitutional idea, which we came to quite unconsciously.
He's one of my favourite writers, and it's a damning indictment of Tony Blair and the architects of the misbegotten venture in Iraq in 2003. Well worth reading. Now, for that and more on Australia and the world, go to our homepage, abc.net.au/rn, and follow the prompt. And remember, if you'd like to hear our program again or send us a comment, just go to that site. Thanks for your company on Between the Lines this week. I'm Tom Switzer. Hope you can tune in again next week.